Today's program was brought to you by Bonnie Plants, bonnieplants.com.
I'm Laura Stanley, host of Inside School Food. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, and welcome to the food scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Chris Fisher of Beetlebung Farm, who got too excited at the beginning of this show. And yes, Chris, it is my favorite day of the week. Even better that you're here today.
Thank you
so much for being here. You know, I was reading through the cookbook and reading about you, and I realized I don't think I know the 12th generation of anything. How does that feel to be that kind of legacy?
It's a lot of pressure. I was growing up on Martha's Vineyard. I always found it interesting how you introduce yourself to people. It's like, my name's Chris. I'm Albert's son, Ozzy's grandson, and you have to give people a point of reference. So it kind of keeps you honest. You don't want to embarrass anybody.
Yeah.
So checks and balances.
And where you are specifically on Martha's Vineyard, Chomark, how many years? 250, 350?
For our family?
Yeah.
Actually, my grandfather grew up in Vineyard Haven, which is where the ferry boat comes into. It's a little more built up. His father was from New Jersey and somehow made his way over there and actually lived on a little island off the coast of Martha's Vineyard called No Man's Land. It's a good name, and he had a cod fishing business. There's a essay about it in the book, and it became so popular at one point, it was, the way he wrote about his process was beautiful, and they had actually boats that were designed to be launched off of No Man's Land in the heavy surf, and they dried the you can read about it in the book, but they dried the fish in the sun, and they had a school over there, and they would sail to New Bedford, they would sail to the vineyard and have parties. Then he moved to Vineyard Haven, and he had the first gas pump on Martha's Vineyard. And he said, there's no future in gas, and he sold it. And anyway, so my grandfather grew up in Vineyard Haven during the Depression, and he kind of farmed his way around the island, and eventually he had opportunities at other farms to purchase them and worked his whole adult life and bought the farm in 1961. So that's really the first, and I mean the roads weren't paved actually when he bought it. Some of the roads, there was no electricity in the town next door, so it was a very different place.
So it was truly a homestead at that point. Like you were sustainable, you know, you were completely devoted to whatever land you live on.
Yeah, I think living on Martha's Vineyard. It's an island off of the coast of Cape Cod, and you have to be able to support yourself if you're on an island, and it's the 1700s, and you don't have any modern-day conveniences. But luckily, you also have the most amazing pantry in your backyard. My grandfather grew up in the Depression, and he said that the Depression was easy for his family. The government offered them subsidies and food stamps, and they turned them all down and told them to give them to other people because they were just bartering for whatever they needed, and they had all the food they needed. And so, he definitely taught me how to take care of myself, I guess.
Yeah.
And others.
Yeah, and you talk about that pantry, and, you know, let's mention again the sustainability of an island or that area of New England in general. There's this idea that it's always just lobster bakes and clam digging. And, I mean, is that what food and growing up in Martha's Vineyard kitchen was like?
Yeah, I grew up both in Chomark and Aquinnah, and Aquinnah's an even smaller town on that side of the island. Chomark has about 800 year-round residents, and Aquinnah has, I think, half that. I was the only kid in my fourth grade class, which I like to mention because I was number one in my class as well. So it was really, really rural. The first house I lived in also didn't have indoor plumbing. We had an outhouse. We lived between the ocean and the pond, and we had pet raccoons. We had pet crows, pet swans, and my dad was a fisherman. He went to the Vietnam War. He came back. He fished on sword fishing boats. He was a lobsterman. He kept lobster pots my whole life. He had a backyard garden. He hunted. And so those foods that you associate with coastal New England cooking or Martha's Vineyard, first of all, they're delicious. I mean, oysters, lobsters, you can't go wrong with that. But they're everywhere, too, and they're easy to get. And so it was. We were just, my dad had 10 lobster pots when I was growing up that he kept really close to our house, and he had a keeper pot, and he would go out and fill the keeper pot all summer, and then at, you know, various times my brother and he and I would sit outside and we would eat as many lobsters as we could. And I was a teenager, and it's like you could just literally have as many as you wanted, and it was didn't feel like anything besides normal.
See, I like how motivated by food you were at a young age, because there's a little passage in here about you cooking in high school at a local restaurant and deciding, I don't actually want to cook. I want to be a dishwasher because they get fed better.
Yeah. Yeah, I used to ride my bike to and from work, and I didn't have a flashlight on my bike. And again, Martha's Vineyard is just, there's a reason why it's become this destination. It's a truly special place, and I just like, even that experience is one of those things I look back on of being in high school and riding home at the end of the shift and being full because I got to feed myself. And the dishwashers were much cooler than the cooks at that time, too. I don't know what it was. But and also, since then, like I always take care of the dishwashers the best because you have to rely on them for everything. And I cooked a meal last week, and it's pretty fancy, and every course I brought, I made a course for the dishwasher as well as the guests. And yeah, riding home at night, no lights, like you could hear deer on the side of the road, car would come and you'd get blinded, you come up over this hill at the Allen farm and the moon would be out over the water. And sorry, that's kind of a tangent, but yeah, that I was hungry. I was an athlete and I was growing, and if you can work and eat, that was the other thing too as I got older, like why not work in a restaurant? You can just eat all day long and you save on food bill. I mean, that's still like, I never have food in my fridge.
That was my concept. I didn't want to be a starving artist. I just wanted to be an artist.
Yeah.
So like work in the food industry.
Exactly. I think my entire adult life, I've like, when I lived in New York City, there was beer in my fridge and that was it. Even now, like I work on a farm, work in restaurants, there's like no food in my fridge ever because I just eat. That's the other thing about farming too, it's like walking through the field, if you're hungry, just like plop off an asparagus, eat some parsley, it's good for your breath, vitamin C. Yeah, it's great.
So why did this island kid want to move to New York City?
I have weird like sleeping habits and energy, and like I just am always, you know, even as a teenager and in college, I would like drive overnight to crazy places and run marathons, and like just like I had an enormous amount of energy. I would ride my bike to, I was a stonemason for a little while. I would ride my bike at 5 a.m., build stone walls all day, and then ride back. I worked one job that I canoed to every day. I had like an enormous amount of energy. And so coming to New York, it was just like this frenetic place that you could stay awake at all hours. And it's just like when you grow up on an island and you aren't exposed to a lot of things that you are in New York City, just getting there, your like mind explodes. And then being interested in food and also being somewhat competitive, it's like, why don't we just go to the best and see if you can make it? And my dad gave me a great work ethic and the idea that you should enjoy your work too. So I just like dove in and worked really hard.
What was it about your first meal at Babbo that was so enjoyable?
Well, I pretty sure I ate a ribeye steak for two that was just like cooked perfectly. And subsequently, when I worked there, I found out, you know, the whole process, they got that from La Frida, and porcini, brown sugar, marinade. They just like soak it in that for a couple days and then grill it perfectly. And it was like, I'd never had, finished it with some aged balsamic. Like these are, I'd never had anything like that. And like the mouthfeel of the ribeye, I can certainly still remember. I had a ribeye last night, actually, at Il Buco. It was really good. After that party. And the music, I mean, that's back when Mario was in control of the iPod and it was like rock and roll. David Lynch was a sommelier and it was like, you know, the whole experience, the service, it was so fancy and foreign to me, but so incredibly enjoyable. So yeah, I was just like, this, I want to be a part of this.
I believe you started at 22 years old.
I was 22 or 23. I'm like, try to go back and like, especially with writing the book, like figure out dates, but I don't, I'm like,
no, this is the first year I forgot what year things happened in.
Yeah.
So I'm not even going to try anymore. But in 2.5 years, you made your way to sous chef at Babbo.
Yeah, it was actually a little bit less than that. I think, well, first of all, you know, my family has always taught me to be very modest, and including with this book, and you know, they were uncomfortable, certain members just talking about themselves, and so I'm kind of like the aberration to just like tell everyone all their personal business, so they don't, some people are a little uncomfortable with that. But when it came to Babbo, like I think that, first of all, I think there's just something wrong with me, period. Like I just have a weird enjoyment of work and food and being creative, and so like if I get focused on something, I can just kind of enjoy it and tune lots of things out. And I was like 22, 23. I had all that energy. And I was really naive. I had no idea what I was doing. So I just worked really hard. And I didn't know anything. And I still don't know anything. And luckily with farming and cooking and writing, that you just get to keep learning forever. But I didn't know any better, and I just like worked really hard, and I liked it, and I would pick up other people's shifts. I was trying to remember one. There was one point that I worked like 30 something days in a row, or every time I tell that story, I add like 10 days to it. So it's probably like 6 days in a row. But oh, now it's at like 36.
Yeah, I have my 114 hour work week pay stub, which I don't have the stub anymore, but I think it was about that.
Excuse me. The one thing I tell cooks that I cook with now, like when they ask me for advice, if they do, first of all, I tell them not to be a cook because it's actually not as fun in restaurants as it seems on TV. Well, actually, that's not true. It's not for everybody. Well, if they want to make money, don't be a cook. If you want to eat well, be a cook. Actually, I don't tell anybody not to be a cook. I don't know why I said that. It's just my new radio personality.
No, that's right. I let you figure that out for yourself.
Yeah, this is like therapy. I like this. Nobody's listening to this, right?
It's just me and you.
I don't know how I figured this out, but it was a good lesson. Like, I just worked as hard as I could, and I made my coworkers' jobs easier. Like, if somebody's cutting board was dirty, I would clean it. If somebody's trash was full, I would empty it. I would look at their prep list and try to figure out how to, like... And that was, like, that was a huge... That, I think, was that really just progressed me, was that, like, if your kitchen mates are like, oh, this guy's actually pretty helpful, it makes my job easier. And then, so I just continued to do that every step of the way. And I had great... I worked under some great... You know what's a pet peeve of mine is when people say my sous chef. Have you heard that? That's like so common in cooking.
Possessive.
Now. Yeah, I hate it. It just drives me insane. Somebody said that to me the other day, and I was like, I've actually certain people that work for me when they say that, I'm like, don't say that. That's so rude to that person.
Yeah, it also creates a caste system that doesn't have to be. And like you're explaining right now, you need everyone to work at their full potential, but harmoniously.
Exactly.
To be a successful cook, restaurant person.
And I was an athlete, too. I played basketball, and I was a point guard. And I always... The other thing, too, is I always, like, always think about those lessons learned playing high school sports and sports before that. And a lot of cooks, too, will be like, you know, it's like kind of like not cool to like sports. And a lot of people in kitchens, they're kind of, they're in a kitchen for a reason. They're kind of counterculture. And I always like try to like, you know, I coached sports for a long time, too. And I would read Mike Krzyzewski's biography and who is that? Vince Lombardi's biography. And like, you know, there's so much that applies to a kitchen, obviously, and if you can do it right. But, yeah.
Well, we're actually going to take a quick break and come back and talk about when New York wasn't enough for you, when you had to travel the world, and why the island drew you back to your home. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We'll be right back.
Could an app be the answer to a better garden? Absolutely. It's the new free app, Homegrown with Bonnie Plants. Note, track, and photograph your garden's progress. Personalize your weather and reminders. Get variety info, grow guides, hands-free dictation, and more. The Homegrown with Bonnie Plants app, the sharpest tool in your garden. Download it free on the App Store.
Hey, and welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan-Turkel, here again with Chris Fisher of Beetlebung Farm. And before we launch into why you went back to the island itself, let's talk about the term... end of the show. Done. That's the answer. Beetlebung. What does it mean?
Beetlebung is a tree. There's a big grove of them on the farm. They're beautiful. They're known by various names off the island, although I've never seen them on the off the island. They like to grow in swamps. It's called Tupelo or black gum tree off the island, and they were a really hard wood, and they're used to patch casks on whaling ships. And they're gorgeous. Their foliage is amazing. There's a little pond that they surround on Beetlebung Farm.
Was there any specific tree? Was there one that you maybe carved your name into? One that you sat under that nurtured you in a way, kind of like Shel Silverstein's book, that made you want to come back to the island and respect, you know, that history, that etymology, that those roots?
Yeah. I mean, a literal tree or a figurative tree?
We could talk. It could be one.
There's a couple. I mean, there's amazing trees on Martha's Vineyard all over the place, actually. And climbing trees was a great activity as a kid, and I also worked for my cousin's tree care company for a while. I worked every job under the sun, which is really helpful when you run a farm because you can figure out how to fix most things. I think what I was getting to before about sort of introducing yourself as, you know, Albert's son and Ozzy's grandson and that sense of place and that pride, I definitely missed it when I was off the island, and I wanted to come back. And I mean, that's the point of the book in so many ways, is to share the story of this community a community that's celebrated on Martha's Vineyard, but Martha's Vineyard oftentimes is more celebrated than the community. Like, you know, the president vacations there, and that's all people want to talk about. And, like, he ate in the restaurant I worked at once. And I think there's, like, five restaurants, and he was staying nearby. So I take it that it was just the most convenient restaurant. And people, like, always ask me about that. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know. There was a lot of Secret Service there. And it's an honor, but I'd like to think that he just came by accident.
And, like, when you think about seasonality, too, that is such a small part of the year on Martha's Vineyard.
Totally.
So this book really is a tome. It's a document of what the island is like every single day of the year. I don't mean consistently, mm-hmm. but how it changes, how it feeds you differently, mm-hmm. how you're inspired by it.
Definitely. That was Catherine Young's idea, my co-author, to start the book in September, when the natural idea would be to start it in the summer, because that's when it's known for. And also, it's just a true record of a year of cooking on Martha's Vineyard. And with my family existing there for so long, I like to think that it's 350 years in the making, but just a year of, like, a snippet. And so as far as when we were conceptualizing the book, like, how do you categorize? Everybody wants to call it farm to table, and I hate that word so much. And then there was seated farm to table at one point, and I just, you know, I don't even, we don't have to be negative or get into whatever that stuff is, but.
Well, don't you have a table on the farm?
Yeah,
that seems
true.
More appropriate.
Crisp, yeah. But yeah, so as far as, like, the seasonality of it, it's, we didn't do four seasons. At one point we talked about doing 12 months of the year and four seasons, and now it's just like, pick a random day. Here's the menu on that random day of the year. And the seasons change so much week to week, day to day. Like, you have such an intimate relationship with the ingredients there that it wasn't fitting to sort of put anything in a box. And yeah, it's even from when I left 2 days ago and when I get back in a couple of days, it's like a completely different cuisine.
Yeah. I think there are 17 menus, all wonderfully designed letterpress by Emma.
Mm-hmm.
And they are signifiers of, you know, not even micro or macro seasons, but just of these benchmarks of the year. I was looking at your blog and bluefish,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's also a recipe of bluefish and parchment in the book itself. What does that mean to you throughout the year when you see that first run of bluefish?
Oh, it's like mouthwatering. It's like you can't sleep the night before because you can smell them coming. My dad is like, I mean, that's the other reason for writing the book, is like his relationship with nature is like the most powerful thing in the world. Like, we'll be on the beach and first of all, he'll be able to see the fish through the water from far away. You know, he can read the water incredibly. But he said to me before, like, I just smelled a couple bluefish swim by, and I didn't catch them. And I'm like, he can literally smell two fish swim by. It's crazy. And when you go fishing with him on a boat, it's like you always catch fish. And there's a story about my sister who caught a 50-pound striped bass when she was 12 years old. And she definitely inherited his genes of fishing and reading the water. I don't have it. I go out fishing by myself, and it's like, I don't think I've ever caught a fish with, well, that's not true. If I go with my brother, I'll catch fish. But if I go by myself, I don't really.
Yeah.
I catch trout, and they're like this big. And I like try to take a picture of it so it looks
so
like
it's not actual. Like fish in a bucket.
No.
No.
It used to be.
You have a recipe for griddled squid.
Mm-hmm.
That, too, is one of those signifiers on the island.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the squid come in the spring and in the fall, and they'll show up at random times. I wish I knew a little bit more about them, but they definitely, I think they come and then the bluefish follow them, but the squid are obviously following something. And squid fishing is enormously fun, too. It's like, you go down to the docks at night and take a flashlight, and they're attracted to the light, and you just dangle a squid jig over the thing, and they just pull them up, and they squirt ink all over you. And like, it's for kids, it's the best, because it's safe, it's kind of adventurous at night, it's scary, it's like so photogenic. We should have photographed that. Yeah, it's when they're fresh like that too, it's, yeah, you can save the ink and do stuff with the ink, and then they're so good.
So you just mentioned something about family, you know, about how that's child friendly, but you know, the island itself has been family friendly, especially for yours, for hundreds of years. How important is it to be inclusive of everyone on the island and, you know, everyone that you cook for at Beach Plum?
It's wonderfully inclusive, and I'm not cooking at the Beach Plum anymore. I don't know if you knew that, but yeah, we went into that restaurant and really wanted to, we did special Sunday night dinners. We did benefits for the school system, the island grown school system, where the kids came in and cooked with us, and they actually worked as every staff member had a trail. And there's these elementary school kids, and some of them, it was the funniest thing. Some of them we wanted to offer jobs to.
It's like baseball. Yeah. You draft them right out of middle school.
Exactly. But in a community like that, that's small and tight-knit, that's the great thing, is all the families that come down and enjoy each other's, you know, and get to know one another, and you see the same families every year, and then also the families that you're integrated into, like the elderly are really well taken care of by their families, and that's just a way of life. And I spend a lot of time with people of every age, and that's the beauty of, you know, in the cities you can kind of pick and choose. In New York you can see the same people that work at the same place and are your age, and it's, you know, it's a little easier in a little community like that. It's just, yeah, we used to eat lunch every day at the farm growing up in the summertime. And sometimes there was four generations of fishers at the table, my grandparents, my dad's generation, my generation, and then the kids, my cousin's kids. And it's like, that's crazy. It's amazing. Like 25 of us.
Yeah. Well, when your Aunt Marie retired 5 years ago, did you feel that familiar obligation to keep Beetle Bung?
Totally. Yeah. No, I had felt a lot of pressure, and I really didn't know what I was doing, and I still don't know what I'm doing. And it was a great amount of pressure to keep it going and keep it the same, but also kind of bring my own perspective of things. And I had learned from my grandfather how to dumpster dive at a young age and recycle everything, and we kind of just like took a shed from my mom's house and dragged it over here and painted this sign. I found some old paint and I like finger painted some signs. I remember this yellow sign that said Beetle Bung Farm. And I also had been blessed to work for Keith McNally, who would take these incredible old things, and I mean, his aesthetic is the best. And so to have observed that, and then to be able to do it with actual free materials, and it was definitely a balance between my grandfather's cheapness and his like incredible eye for that old stuff. Yeah. So I feel very lucky.
Well, I feel like you have that same ideology when we talk about your food. You know, your menu is reliant on these kind of tried and true techniques, but have these nuances of modern cuisine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the idea was, well, to be a farmer and a fisherman on Martha's Vineyard traditionally was meant that, you know, you lived simply and you ate really well, and you had these ingredients that we've been talking about at your fingertips. And so, like we said before, that's how I grew up eating. And then to be able to cook in all these places that I was fortunate enough to cook in, and take this and that from all those techniques and thoughts and references. And I also am a voracious eater, and I'm staring at that cheeseburger right there. It looks so good. So yeah, to bring all those things together, and we wanted the food to be very accessible and cookable. And then we also, I always thought of it like, because the people that come and work on the farm or work with me or are attracted to Beetle Bung, it's like, I wanted a chef to be able to take the book and see it and recognize these techniques or this like choice for simplification and say like, that makes more sense than doing, you know, adding 10 things to it. And then I also wanted a home cook to take simple food, make it more delicious than they ever dreamed possible with 4 ingredients, and have that confidence and maybe learn a new technique or how to treat something a little bit better than they did before. And so, that was my dream. My dream to write a book, but once that was done, it was like to think about if people actually read it, which I'm not sure there's one copy there. So we've got one copy out there. To be able to like have anybody pick up the book and say like, wow, that's, you know, there's some very complicated things here and there, and there's like the most basic thing in the world. So, but there's a nice balance.
What I had been telling you before the show is it's the tone. It's very special. It's very conversational. It's very you now having sat here for, you know, 30 minutes, you can see yourself, you know, reciting these things to a writer or to a young cook or to a friend, and them all taking it with the same value.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you. Like I said, you know, we've got one copy here. You may be the only person that's read it or will read it, but if, as long as you're inspired by it, then we've done our job. My mom was a teacher, and she was a special education teacher, and she influenced so many people. When she passed away, I remember going to the funeral, and there was a million memories from that day, from body surfing before the funeral was like the most incredible. I didn't want to get out of the water. We took the door of her refrigerator because she decorated it with magnets and art, and we hung it, like put it in the center of the hall where the funeral was. That was a cool move. She had these quotes on it that were like, it's just so amazing. She had a little advertisement that I loved for this snowboarding company, which is a little mouse wearing a helmet going into a mouse trap. Have you ever seen that in commercial? It's really good. But I just remember looking out of the hall, and there was traffic in West Tisbury, and there's only traffic during the fair, and it was all of her former students coming to pay tribute to her. And there's one woman that I know that gave me a quote that was, your mom, she was her second grade teacher, and she said, she was the first person to teach me to color outside the lines. And I just always remembered that because I feel like that's what I've been doing my whole life. And I feel okay with it. But she was a teacher. So I spent a lot of time with her. I drove to school with her every morning. I'd sit in her classroom and see her work with kids. And she taught me a few things.
Yeah. Well, it must feel special to be at this point in your life where you can have something like this that you can pass down that can be archival, and you get to teach people in the same way that many generations of fishers have.
Yeah, that was the point. Was, you know, there's a lot of verbal skills that are passed down and nonverbal skills and it from generation to generation in a small community, like a rural community. And the Foxfire books, that are some great books written in the 1960s, I believe, in West Virginia, I believe. I always thought it was Maine, but there are these great series of books about Appalachian living, and that was a big inspiration for this book, and we looked at this a lot. And there was something in there that inspired me. It was how to make cottage cheese, and I'd never heard of anyone making cottage cheese. And I was like, now it's going to go on some menu somewhere. It's going to be on the menu here tomorrow.
Awesome. Well, at least with this book, we know how to make creme fraiche.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's where the creme fraiche or the ricotta, but I wanted to put a cottage cheese recipe in the book. And so I was looking at them, and then I was just realizing the value of that type of book.
What is your father's name?
Albert.
And your grandfather's name?
Albert.
So when I come to the island, I know to at least introduce myself as, oh, I know Chris, son of Albert, son of Albert.
Yes. And my brother, yes. I don't know why. I got skipped on a lot of things. I didn't get, my brother got the same initials. He got a shotgun when he was 12. I got a radio. I don't know what I just wasn't. And then I'd steal the shotgun. It was probably like they didn't trust me to shoot the gun. My sister too, she's the best shot in the family. She's like such a little badass. She's so funny. She'll like, we used to drive around in the truck with the .22, which is illegal. Don't do it. And dangerous. And, she was like eight, and she'd like have it, the gun on her lap, and we'd see a rabbit, and she'd be like, "Huh, hey," and I'd like pull over, and she'd just lean out and just pick off the rabbit, and we'd keep driving. And then we would feed the rabbits to the red-tailed hawks that lived in the neighborhood, so we had a nice friendship with them. They would fly over us, and my dad would feed them, and we'd come down and watch them eat, and it was pretty amazing. Those things are scary. You ever seen one of those?
Oh, yeah.
The other fun thing that we used to do as a kid, I feel like, but similar to that, was we used to go to Penike's Island, which is a small island on the other side. I guess it's in the Elizabeth Island chains. And it was a leper colony at one point. So they'd ship them over there, and there was like, I'd picture like caves and cages and stuff. I don't know exactly what they lived in, but the lepers went over there, and then it became a place for juvenile delinquents, which is an amazing thing. Like, you're from wherever, and you do whatever, and you go to this place, and it's this little island with nobody on it. There's one little building and a farm, and you live there, and you figure out your life. And the newspaper was delivered every day by seaplane. I remember it'd like fly over. But we would go once a summer with these marine biologists, and my dad would take us to band baby seagulls. And so you walked around this uninhabited island, you'd find seagull nests, which, like, what, who knows that skill as an adult in contemporary, like, how to find a baby seagull is, I don't remember how you did it, but we did it, and we were like 7 years old, and you just walk around, and like, that was, and when you got near a nest, the mother would protect the baby, so they'd come down and they'd they'd stick their talons out and they'd try to scratch you. And I remember getting hit once as a kid, and it like freaked me out, and just right across the scalp. But also, it was like you're also like in a movie too. It was like this fantasy world. It was so fun. And that's what it was like growing up in the woods of Chilmark, like leaving and then coming back. There's so much to see, and the vineyard's a really small place, but I really feel like with my attention span too, it's like you could spend your entire life just in the woods of Chilmark alone and like still not see everything. Like I remember like watching Robin Hood, the cartoon, and then my brother and I like going to this stream and lying in it and finding a reed and like sitting underwater and breathing through the reed. Do you remember that scene when they escape? And there's another funny tradition too that doesn't take place anymore on May Day. You know, May Day, the maypole. In elementary school, on May Day, all the kids hid, and the teachers had to find them, and the last person to be found won. And early on, there was no rules to where you could hide. You could hide anywhere. So you would like just run through the woods. And I'm like, how, in retrospect, it's like, how did the teachers ever actually find you? Like, I remember kids would go to like the next town over. And when you're young, you're like really scared. I remember my first hiding place, the school's here, the big toys here. I went in the slide and I just like hung. Like, I think my first hiding place was under the front steps of the school. So they like walk out and they're like, yeah, we got him. He's in kindergarten. And then first grade, you hide like on the slide, like hanging there. They can probably just see your fingertips. And then you gradually like, I think I pulled the reed trick one year, but then got like hypothermia from being in the pond next door. Or you'd hide underneath like buildings. But this one kid won one year because he locked himself in the trunk of the principal's car. And like hours later, everyone's like, all right, Simon won. Where is he? Simon, and it was like, and you just like hear this faint like kicking, and they let him out. So that doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah. Well, I'm happy to know that the food on Martha's Vineyard, especially Beetlebung Farm, is as exciting as your life was there.
Sure. Well, it's like I think if you're excited about it, then other people can be too.
Yeah. Often I tell people at the end of the show, you know, buy the book.
Mm-hmm.
But more so, go to Martha's Vineyard, because if you've never been, it is as magical, if not more, than you're describing. And what you've contributed to it only makes it more idyllic.
Yeah, the more that you know about a place, the more the visitors that come are going to want to honor that or be a part of it or support it. And so there's a lot of traditions that could disappear on Martha's Vineyard. There's a huge farming movement right now on the vineyard, which is so important that, you know, the traditional New England homestead, which is what Beetlebung Farm essentially is, and these small farms in New England are so important for our food systems. And we've gone away from that. And if you can educate people and just, you know, to go back to the whole farm to table movement, that is occurring, and everyone's tired of that word. But if you can really educate people on what it means to buy directly from farmers and support the right kind of fishing and the producers that are doing things properly with the animals they're raising, like, then you can start to correct things. And especially people have been talking about California for a long time, and a friend of mine was talking about it a few years ago, and they were saying, you know, California is in trouble. And she said, like, she was like, what you're doing on the farm, what's happening, what traditionally happened, where, you know, it was a part of your life and it was small scale and it was realistic. And, you know, that's important, and that needs to be shared. And I didn't, that stuck with me, but I realized it more and more, like, you know, and I'm an educated eater and an educated, somewhat educated, person. And it's all natural to me, but, you know, most Americans, a lot of people don't, you know, don't think about how much their food choices influence things.
Well, it's ingrained in you, but it's certainly embedded in the book as well. And on top of the wonderful recipes, it's a must read for all that thought behind it. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was a pleasure having you on, and I certainly am going to make my way out to that small island south of Cape Cod soon.
Well, you're more than welcome. That's the other thing growing up there is, like, I never owned keys to my house. I never knew where they were, and you left your keys in your ignition. And so if you come and you just figure out where I live, then the door's open.
Well, I at least know if I see a man smelling a fish, it's most likely a fisher.
Yes.
You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3.
Sure.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.